wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. Portland listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. It's April 1st, otherwise known as April Fool's Day. I checked on the origin of this odd day and discovered no one really knows, although the idea is centuries old. The first mention of April Fool's Day in English comes in 1686, when biographer John Aubrey described April 1st as a fool's holy day. Presumably, President Trump will spend the day in worship. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today, Clayton Margaret shares with us an article from the Jacobin website, Organizing to Win a Green New Deal. You've undoubtedly heard that many geologists now argue that we've entered the new geological age they call the Anthropocene. I'll be reading an article entitled Reinhabiting Planet Earth by Robert Kohler, which deals with this subject. Lori Mercier talks with Dana Frank, a Central American expert, about U.S. policies in that troubled region. Bill Resnick leads off today's program interviewing Michael Hirsch. Michael Hirsch is a labor journalist, writes a lot, including on working in reform for revolutionary ends. The interview discusses reform and revolution as a profoundly important and timely issue. Bill?
Michael Hirsch, welcome to KBOO.
Happy to be here.
Michael Hirsch is a New York labor journalist, an outspoken socialist. He writes, he advocates. He's active in many movements and with the Democratic Socialists of America. He's one of us, including me, who believe that it will require democratic socialist arrangements of production and daily living to save us from the environmental devastation and also the social inequality that are fast worsening in this country. In fact, these developments are threatening human life on this planet, and they're the products of our current arrangements known as capitalism. In a recent article in the journal New Politics, Michael Hirsch contends that us socialists can do politics and can honestly work in all of the great movements and the environmental movement and social justice work and the unions, in the movement for universal health care, the movement to end policing as we know it, the feminist movement. He also argues that we can be socialists and work in the Democratic Party, though with great care, which is a controversial question for the left. But tell me, Michael, let's start with that, the Democratic Party. Tell us about the whole question.
The whole question is a very old question. When I was 18, I went to a debate at City College between one of the top editors of a newspaper called the National Guardian and a spokesman for the Communist Party. And the discussion was extremely polemical and extremely nasty. The speaker who opposed voting for Lyndon Johnson argued that Johnson was an imperialist, that there was nothing to be gained by the supporting the Democrats. The speaker for the Communist Party accused the National Guardian speaker of being a supporter of fascism.
Uh-huh.
I was only 17 at the time, and I thought this is a very serious argument, and I had to know where I stood on that. In my life, I'm still on both sides of that argument. Not the vulgar and polemical side, but I've gone in my life from thinking it was impossible to reform the Democrats to thinking there were incremental things you could do that could advantage a social movement. And that's the position I hold today, that support for the Democrats is tactical. That it makes sense in some places and makes no sense in other places. And that it's never a strategic question, but it's a tactical question.
Michael, one question, though, I want to ask you about.
Shoot.
And that is the question, once you work in the Democrats, now in the primaries, of course, you can you can do a lot more. But once you get a candidate and you've sort of gotten into the Democratic Party and you recognize how ugly the opponents would be, and at least this Democrat might protect some of the movements, and some of them may be, in fact, pretty good people, well, you get sucked into then supporting that Democrat and supporting the discipline that the party imposes and the candidate imposes to not talk about socialism, to not acknowledge that you may be a socialist, and to do this kind of least common denominator politics. Avoid everything, be sort of imperialist, but with a heart in some way. How do you avoid that problem? People get sucked into that, into doing these least common denominator politics and lose their own politics in the process when you're going house to house and talking to people and basically mouthing, there's a word that I can't say on the air, but it's bull, and then it keeps going. You could say it after 10 o'clock, though, Michael, so you don't have to be. How do you deal with that problem?
The only thing you could do in a situation like that is to know going into it that the only way to keep elected officials on the straight and narrow is by having a base, by organizing people on a community level and on an industrial level in a work situation where they are mobilized and make demands. There's no other way to control a politician than to threaten them or to be in a position to help them. But it has to be on the basis of needs, of felt needs, and an understanding of why you're in politics to begin with. In New York, housing is a major question. The most powerful institution in New York State is the Real Estate Board of New York, far and away. Every fight is a fight over rent control and over housing. I'm sure Portland is in a similar situation, but in New York, housing is in crisis. New York City has rent control. New York State does not. There's no other way to change that than to make sure that the politicians are indebted to who they're to a base. That means you don't simply get active in the party. You get active in building a community of interest that then becomes, in effect, the pressure on the party. Now, this is what the old socialists tried to do and failed miserably at, but it's necessary. Now, the question of whether there's a future in the Democratic Party, to me, is academic. It's possible that the Democratic Party can become a party of the left. It's also likely that it will implode. I don't know which of those two is going to happen. I don't care which of those two is going to happen. As long as we have a base that militates for anti-corporate, anti-capitalist politics, there's what I would call felt need that transcends party politics. Short of that, and you're still going to be at the sufferance of an elected official who is easily bribable.
And in fact, it's not only are they bribable, but elected officials have more official power than they have real power, in that capital flight and capital strike is
sure,
always for any elected official. They have to keep this whole operation going.
Sure.
If they offend capital, they're finished. I think that explains the problems of the Democratic Party much more than campaign finance
capital
or bribery. But that's another matter.
Issue.
Yeah, that's another matter. So I don't think we can look to politics, because all politicians have to run on basically they're hostage to the economy. And if the economy goes bad, they get replaced. And if the companies say, you're bad for us and we're going to leave town, that's the viper of death for any politician. Anyway, that's my theory. But we can't depend on them anyway. This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Michael Hirsch, a distinguished labor journalist who's writing and active in all sorts of areas. Michael, let's talk about what can be done in the party. I think think we have different emphases, actually, but we can discuss them. So what's your sense?
Well, one of the things that I'm encouraged by is the broad discussion about the Green New Deal. This has the potential to challenge the fossil fuel industry in a way that corporations have never been challenged in decades. The point is that there are many different definitions of what the Green New Deal can do. I think the bottom line has to be a war against fossil fuels, in part because of the threat to human extinction. If the fossil fuel industry is not tamed and beaten back, but politically, the alternative of renewables is so attractive and makes so much sense that I think that is an overall perspective that we can latch onto. There's going to be a fight as to how to define it.
You know, you're absolutely right, although I think that my theory is that the fossil fuel industry is finished and that the big battle now is not that, although it could. We have to win that one, and we are, but we have to win it quickly.
Oh, for sure.
But the big battle that's really emerging now is between the investor-owned utilities, the IOUs, the Con Edisons, and the Pacific Gas and Electrics, and the Pacific Power, and about 40 other huge international electricity conglomerates, and their suppliers and their financiers, versus community energy, because they could take it over, Michael. The Green New Deal, I think, is going to be hijacked in the Congress, actually. I'm trying to write on that. It's going to be part of an infrastructure deal that will be like the military budget.
It's entirely possible.
Possible.
That's the fight we're going to have.
I know. It's a huge fight. How do we make that fight, then? How do you work within the Democratic Party to make that fight? Because there's so many good people in the Democratic Party at the grassroots. The politicians themselves, though, have no choice but to sort of support corporate capital. But the people in them don't have that vision, a lot of them.
That is the 20th, we used to call the $64,000 question.
I'll give you $5 to answer it right now.
I mean, it's the old argument that the more people you have on your side, the more power you have. I can see a situation in which the old ideologies just don't work anymore. I mean, part of the role of socialists, beyond advocating a whole series of necessary reforms, is to argue a different mindset, to argue a different perspective, that corporate capitalism is no longer necessary, that corporate capitalism is a threat to civilization.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that.
That the choices really are what Rosa Luxemburg said they were, socialism or barbarism. And to get people to see how that reflects on their particular lives. I mean, that slogan is going to be meaningless to people unless it comes down to how it affects them, to what their problems are. We had talked, you and I had talked informally about educational reforms. I think that only the beginning of wisdom in educational reform is the notion of free college education. Free education from pre-K through graduate school. Unless you challenge the curriculum itself, all you're doing is creating people who are capable of taking jobs that may disappear in 10 years. You're not really creating citizens. You're not creating an informed electorate. You're simply reproducing labor power.
And the hierarchy you're reproducing, because...
Oh, very much so. The issues, as we're talking about, have to do so much with what are people's interests. And to the degree that capitalism is no longer meeting basic interests, is the degree that we have to organize people to have an alternative. Let me give you an example. There was a meeting during the summer that was very much in support of Cynthia Nixon, who was running in the New York State against our demented governor. Andrew Cuomo, I call him the lesser Cuomo. She ran an interesting campaign. Several of the insurgent Democratic clubs sponsored a speak out with her. There was absolutely no analysis of the economy. There was no analysis of the big problems. It was an attack on Cuomo start to finish and how she was the better candidate. One of the speakers was a member of Democratic Socialists of America. I fully expected her to give something approaching an anti-corporate rap. She said nothing about that was any different from anything that the liberal Democrats said, which is largely a character assassination of the governor, who dearly deserves a character assassination, but that's besides the point. There was nothing raised about the larger crisis of humanity. And we have to begin talking in that language, in a language that people can understand, not as a Presbyterian minister would do, but as a member of a community speaking to neighbors about a very serious problem. And that was absent in this entire discussion. And these are the better political activists in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, but it seems to me there's another dimension to that. It's not only being anti-capitalist, it's really talking about the possibilities of an alternative and how alternatives to capitalism work in all sorts of spheres.
Absolutely.
In planning, in education that you mentioned, we can do really democratic education. It's happening all the time by a minority of teachers, unfortunately, and often opposed by the principals and the school board. There are curriculums that really introduce kids to what it means to be democratic and to think that way and to recognize the radical possibilities in daily life. And in Portland alone, the curriculum writers of Rethinking Schools, a number of whom are here, their books are wonderful in terms of describing
right.
the alternatives in education. Now there,
I don't know a socialist organization that speaks that language, including my own.
No, I'm afraid that's true, that we've done really poorly, but As you pointed out in one of your articles, there are lots of people who don't consider themselves socialists who, in fact, really do speak that language in many
right.
areas, like, let's say, medicine. Why don't we conclude with that? There are treatises and research studies showing how democracy works in dealing with chronic diseases, that you have to reorganize the system to have teams of equal people making decisions, not dominated by the doctor.
That's right.
That make decisions that work with patients, that give them room to think and discuss and develop their own skills, their families as well. It seems to me that democracy, and it also empowers those nurses and social workers
That's
and
right.
other workers in the system to see themselves as people who are that deserve and are, you know, the boss's brains are under the workers' hats is the
that's
one of my favorite
part.
Lines. They begin
yep.
to see that, and that is, you don't have to call yourself a socialist. When you recognize that, you become a socialist because you
that's
see
right.
that we need to democratize the society. Anyway, that's
and
my
that
line. Michael,
part.
Sorry I went on so long, but...
Okay, I just want to say this. That is not part of the discussion on Medicare for All. And Medicare for All is a wonderful program that absolutely should be fought on by anyone who considers themselves a radical or even a liberal. But it's the beginning of wisdom, and that's all it is, the beginning of wisdom. It's largely a way for the people who are not served by the medical industry now to be served by them, but it doesn't do a critique of the medical industry itself, just as you say.
Yeah, and there's so many opportunities, but those same opportunities are in almost every area of life that democracy works better than top-down hierarchical organization, including
right.
in planning, including in the allocation of capital. There are so many possibilities. Michael, we have to continue the talking, but I think we have run out of time.
Okay.
Michael Hirsch, so thanks so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
And we'll continue this discussion.
That was Bob Marley and the Wailers, Revolution. This is KBO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Clayton Mortgage is here reading from a piece from the Jacobin website, Organizing to Win a New Green Deal. Clayton?
Thank you, Tom. Yes, Jan McElvey has an article on the Jacobin magazine website called Organizing to Win a Green New Deal. It's about how the role of labor is essential to the climate struggle. Jane McElvey has been an organizer and negotiator in the labor movement for over 20 years. She also recently did a great interview about organizing with Daniel Denver on The Dig, a great podcast associated with Jacobin. And here's a very shortened version of her Jacobin piece. Demands for real climate justice got a welcome boost recently as youth walked out of schools worldwide on March 15th. Images in mainstream and social media exploded with pictures of young people marching into plazas across the world confronting intransigent elected officials. But to halt and reverse the carbon economy, save the planet, and create a future with jobs that youth will look forward to requires far more power and a serious strategy. The left has yet to prove it can move from rhetoric to reality about green jobs. The role of unions is crucial. Public service unions can and must negotiate for climate justice. As one organizer said, any seasoned union campaigner worth her salt loves a contract fight because it has a hard deadline that focuses everyone's attention, expiration, and a strike threat. Climate science gives us a new deadline and an opportunity to show that we're up to the task. We have 12 years. If we take the 12 years outlined in the recent IPCC report as our deadline for drastically cutting carbon emissions, what's a credible plan to win by 2030? For people serious about winning really hard fights, making a plan starts by doing comprehensive power structure analysis and building a real war room. This is indeed a war, one that so far has been won by the Koch brothers and their ilk. Our side needs to get used to the military language because what we have been doing, being polite and going to big orderly marches, is not saving the planet or creating a fair and just economy, and it's wishful thinking to imagine otherwise. War rooms are physical spaces where people with necessary experience and fortitude brainstorm and plan what it will take to win. They plan for the world as it actually exists, facing the challenge of organizing a set of messy actors who are too easily divided and conquered and too infrequently able to hold the focus on that which unites us, which is much more than survival. Fortunately, there is one key strategy that has a track record of actually winning the hardest fights in our history, even in spite of increasingly hostile courts. Organizing. Real organizing. Recent victories show that it's possible to build serious power from the ground up in far less time than the Green New Deal's 2030 deadline requires. Three recent examples include the incredible victories waged and won by educators in Chicago, West Virginia, and Los Angeles. In all three cases, smart, progressive, motivated workers with the future of public education at stake transformed moribund, do-nothing organizations into unions capable of leading and winning all-out fights in which the opponents were strong and the odds were stiff. In West Virginia, it took less than a year for a transformation that created a crisis powerful enough to literally flip a Republican, hard-right, fossil-fuel-beholden legislature on its head. All-out strikes can produce that kind of influence. In Chicago and Los Angeles, it took each union 4 years to shift completely from top-down and do-nothing to bottom-up and do-everything well. War rooms and a return to the fundamentals of organizing were key. Are there examples in the climate justice world that might inform what winning looks like? One important example is a recent 3-year endeavor in New York, starting when unions sat down in 2014 to do something serious about climate change. The New York City Labor Council, part of the AFL-CIO, decided that rather than focusing on the 10% of the issues that are divisive, such as the Keystone Pipeline and fracking, it makes more sense to start with the 90% of the issues that environmentalists and unions can easily agree on, including infrastructure, public transportation, and energy production. Environmentalists need to demonstrate with real actions that they can help win high-quality union jobs in these three sectors. Establishing a union-only working group on climate was central to making progress. When Hurricane Sandy hit, it drove home to union members in New York City how serious the issue was, and Irene had hit upstate New York, and everyone was realizing how unprepared we were for what's coming. The storms created an opening for a new conversation that organizers realized had to be union-only discussion about climate change. Environmentalists pay lip service to green jobs, but in practice have consistently failed to recognize that committing to winning high-quality union jobs is essential to effective collaborations with unions. So in 2014, a group of New York unions whose members were hit hard by Sandy decided to start a process to educate themselves about the climate crisis. They formed a working group that included unions key to the solutions in the energy, transport, and infrastructure sectors, as well as the public service unions. They started by bringing in climate scientists to help them better understand the threats. In just 3 years, the working group produced a groundbreaking report titled Reversing Inequality, Combating Climate Change, a Climate Jobs Program for New York State. The unions quickly transitioned from the report to action, using union power to secure a huge victory. New York will get half its total energy needs met by renewable offshore wind power by 2035. A real war room to win the Green New Deal must start with unions doing what unions did in New York. Take initiative, be dead serious about the issue, educate themselves and use their own knowledge and power to scale up and make a credible plan to win. To actually institute a Green New Deal means rebuilding a robust public sector. A robust public sector means a future filled with good jobs for women and people of color. Good unions understand best how to run a hard fight with a serious deadline. It's time for the 2030 War Room now. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Don't go near the water. Don't you think it's sad? What's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea now threatens life on land. Don't go near the water. Ain't it safe?
Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. The poison floating out to sea now threatens life on land. That was the Beach Boys, Don't Go Near the Water, rather ironically, from their album Surf's Up. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You probably heard of the Anthropocene Age, and you're probably aware that we currently live in the Holocene Age. These ages are meant to define geological epochs. The Holocene Age commenced at the end of the last ice age. All of human history since the dawn of agriculture and the rise of civilization has taken place within the Holocene. It was an age of relatively stable climate and comparatively little geological upheaval. Geological science are now suggesting that we have entered into a new age, the Anthropocene. Humanity, they argue, no longer merely exploits and befouls nature, but human activity is now the cause of fundamental and disastrous changes to the natural world. Today I'm sharing an article entitled Reinhabiting Planet Earth by Robert Kohler. Kohler begins with a quotation. I believe that for a moment I thought the explosion might set fire to the atmosphere and thus finish the Earth, even though I knew that was not possible. These words of Manhattan Project physicist Emilio Segre, quoted by Richard Rhodes in his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, refer to the Trinity blast on July 16, 1945, at Alamogordo, New Mexico, the first atomic explosion in history, and so it appears a turning point for all of life on this planet. The atmosphere didn't catch fire on 5:30 that morning, but Segre's words remain relevant, sort of like radioactive fallout. They encapsulate what may be history's ultimate moment of human arrogance, the belief in a sense of separateness from and superiority to nature, so thorough that we have, with our monstrous intelligence, the ability and therefore the right to play bad God and make the whole planet go poof. Turns out the Trinity test set in motion something even more profound than the nuclear era. The bomb didn't just defeat Japan and define the Cold War with a suicidal nuclear arms race. It also, at least symbolically, marks the beginning of what has become to be known as the Anthropocene, an era of profound climate and Earth system destabilization caused by human activity, and therefore, like it or not, establishing humans as co-equal participants in the activity of the natural world. There's more to this co-equal status than nuclear weapons, of course. They may be the tip of our arrogance, but we've been exploiting and rearranging the planet for nearly 12,000 years since the beginning of the era we are now leaving, the Holocene, an era of climate stability in which human civilization and all written history emerged. From the development of agriculture to the Industrial Revolution, the plundering of the earth for oil, coal, the spewing of infinitesimal plastic nurdles across the planet, the creation of continent-sized trash mounds afloat in the oceans, the replacement of biodiversity with monoculture, the poisoning of air and water, and yes, nuclear testing and the spread of radioactive fallout, humanity, or at least a small portion of it, has exercised an intelligence with a serious moral void. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. Or as David Gorton put it, humans might be the first species to knowingly choose self-extinction. In the Anthropocene, the old simplicities are gone, writes Mark Garvin. We are no longer human subjects acting upon an objective nature outside us. Nature and human are now bound together. Free nature is over. Free humanity is over. They are relics of the Holocene. In our new age, Earth and human are entangled irrevocably together. Welcome to the area of the Earth-bound responsibility. The assumptions, the myths, the illusions of the Holocene no longer apply. End quote. And any institution founded on such myths and illusions that the planet is ours to exploit, that some people matter more than others, that national borders are real, that dehumanizing and killing one another keeps us safe, that money equals God and cannot and will not survive in the Anthropocene, and the solutions that emerge from such institutions, for example, solving the climate crisis, are rooted in failure. The challenge, says Garvin, is to rethink and re-inhabit our planet, end quote. That is to say, we have to start over. And I think that's what's happening. New values are percolating. So are old values, the values human beings once embraced as they claimed the right to occupy planet Earth. These values include interdependence and cooperation and profound reverence for the planet. Rupert Ross, in his book Running to the Teachings, points out, for instance, Dakota had no language for insulting other orders of existence. Pest, waste, weed. A distant understanding is not primitive. It includes cooperation and compassion in its grasp of how things work, of what it means to live within the circle of life. The indigenous peoples of the planet have remained its protectors. As EcoWatch, a leading environmental news page, points out, even the seemingly groundbreaking Paris Agreement neither includes human rights in its text nor acknowledges indigenous rights, even though lands and waters stewarded by indigenous communities make up 80% of the world's biodiversity. What we need is for climate policy and the overall climate movement to address problems of inequality, basic climate change is just as much a social issue as it is an environmental issue, end quote. In other words, biodiversity and social diversity are both precious. Knowing this means re-inhabiting the planet, not setting it on fire. That was an article entitled Re-inhabiting Planet Earth by Robert Kohler for the Counterpunch webpage. Robert Kohler, Chicago award-winning journalist and editor. And this is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now Warren Mercier talks with Dana Frank. Dana Frank is a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Since the 2009 military coup in Honduras, she has written extensively about human rights and U.S. policy in Honduras and Central America in general. They'll be discussing Honduras migrants and U.S. policies vis-a-vis Central America.
Thanks, Tom. As you heard, Dana Frank is professor of history emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of many books, including Bananeras, Women Transforming the Banana Unions of Latin America, By American, The Untold Story of Economic Nationalism, and Purchasing Power, Consumer Organizing, Gender in the Seattle Labor Movement. But we're here to talk about her new book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror in the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup, from Haymarket Books. And, as Tom mentioned, her past decade of work to illuminate the horrors of U.S. policies in Honduras. Welcome back to KBOO, Dana Frank.
Thanks so much for having me, Lori.
Well, your book, The Long Honduran Night, is very powerful. And for those who believe that the Obama administration backed off from intervening in Latin America while tied up in the Middle East, this will be a disappointing book, since it exposes in meticulous detail how Obama and Secretaries of State Hillary Clinton and John Kerry supported the coup, anti-democratic dictators, and tried to cover up massive human rights violations and murder there. Why don't you briefly recap the coup for listeners who may have forgotten or not even been aware of U.S. support of the 2009 coup that toppled Manuel Zelaya?
Thanks. We're actually coming up on the 10th anniversary of the coup this June. On June 28, 2009, there was a military coup that deposed democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya. They put him, famously put him on a plane in his pajamas, stopped at a joint U.S. air base in Honduras, and then flew him to Costa Rica. We don't have a smoking gun that the U.S. backed the coup ahead of time, but we do know that the U.S. did everything it could in its aftermath to stabilize the coup regime, and that's what, and the, when you're trying to understand the migration and the caravans and the crisis in Honduras today, it flows from this U.S.-backed post-coup regime, which really just not only deposed the president, but just has destroyed the rule of law in Honduras ever since, just opening the door to everything hideous that we know about in Honduras, rampant drug trafficking and killing of people by drug traffickers, gangs, violence, and also just the gutting of the state and destruction of good jobs. So that coup, which is 10 years ago on June 28th, really opened the door to what this spectacular disaster in its aftermath.
But as you point out, the media coverage and certainly the Trump administration's demonization of migrants focuses on gangs and kind of sensational violence associated with drug running, and not at all about the U.S. responsibility in
The media coverage, the mainstream media coverage, is if it's a natural disaster, you know, that the people just can't govern themselves down here, down there. And it's really important to understand that these people are refugees, as the UN has called them, and they're refugees from U.S. policy. And the U.S. policy has been to support these repressive regimes that are interlocked with drug traffickers at the very top. For example, the Minister of Security, Julian Pacheco Tinoco, the current Minister of Security in charge of all the police, he's a former general, has been twice named in U.S. court. Federal court has overseen drug trafficking fights. The top three directors of the police have been documented by the Associated Press to be involved in cocaine trafficking. And at the top of this is Juan Orlando Hernandez, the purported president of Honduras, who's a dictator, who was part of the coup, who overthrew the Supreme Court in 2012, who ran against the Constitution of Honduras, says you can't run for president as for re-election, and the Supreme Court that he named legally then said that he could run, and then in 2017, in November 2017, Juan Orlando Hernandez, the dictator, was clearly, despite all of this, behind the opposition candidate. And then when the elections of 2017 happened, when he was trying to get reelected illegally, and then they shut down the computers and then announced later that he had, in fact, won the election, although all the evidence made clear that the opposition candidate was winning. So, and then, of course, the U.S. then recognizes this man whose brother is now arrested in the United States for drug trafficking, a prominent Congress member. So this government is narcos all over the place. The Attorney General sits on all kinds of evidence. The police sit on kind of evidence. And also even stuff like, you know, that you might think of as separate, not just drug trafficking, but gangs. A lot of, if you listen to the stories of the migrants, they're fleeing gangs, a lot of them, and real gang terror that I think people know about up here. But the police are very much tied in with those gangs. If small businesses try to report gang extortion, for example, the police then tell the gangs, and the gangs will come back and kill you. And I know a community in the suburbs of San Pedro Sula where this kind of things happens all the time. If you complain to the gang extortionist that comes around to make you pay as a small business people, then the police disappear from the street, somebody comes and kills you, and then the police go back the next day. So it's not random violence or just randomly proliferating gangs and drug traffickers. It's actually embedded at the very top of the state.
And much of that targeting of people is also due to their political activism, is it not? Just
absolutely. You know, these same police and security forces killed at least 22 people who were peacefully protesting or just bystanders at peaceful protests in the aftermath of the 2017 elections. And the United Nations just a week and a half ago said, again, these cases remain overwhelmingly in impunity. That means no one's gone to jail. Someone at the very top of the government made that call to use live bullets for the first time in the aftermath of the elections, and that means they're killing people just for protesting or watching a protest. And the U.S. is looking the other way. You know, the other piece of this is that people are fleeing poverty, quote-unquote, but poverty is, again, a result of very explicit U.S.-backed policies in the United States. I mean, Juan Orlando Hernandez, the dictator, and his cronies are just robbing the government coffers blind, and then when major government agencies, such as electrical company, get privatized and go bankrupt, then U.S.-backed multilateral development banks then give Honduras new loans to fill the coffers back up. And so you don't have state services. The National Health Service was gutted to pay for the president's previous campaign in 2013. That's documented by the Attorney General. So you have this sort of mass poverty. And then a lot of, you know, we have a lot of debates now we could talk about aid to Honduras, but it's really important to understand that a lot of the model for development aid is itself creating poverty, in whether through mines and dams that destroy indigenous lands and throw people off their lands, palm oil production, monoculture that is being imposed at the point of gun, and at least 150 campesinos have been killed in this process of imposing palm oil production. So it's not like a happy model of development that the U.S. is backing down there either.
And we want to return to that subject of U.S. motives for supporting these repressive governments, not only in Honduras, but other places. And in reading about the rise to power of Juan Orlando Hernandez and his seizing control over the government, it certainly sounds very reminiscent of what is happening in Venezuela with Juan Guaido. It almost seemed like perhaps the Trump administration is borrowing the blueprint from the Obama administration about how to take over in terms of using Orlando Hernandez did the Honduran Congress to come to power.
Well, I mean, the main thing to see is that the U.S. is enacting regime change, or trying to, in both Nicaragua and in Venezuela, just as they overthrew Zelaya in Honduras. And, you know, now you can also see this hypocrisy, because all these tools that suddenly U.S. is using against Maduro in Venezuela and Ortega in Nicaragua, whatever we think of those two leaders, that playbook is not being used against the dictator in Honduras right now, who clearly stole the election, whose security forces have clearly killed people. And why is the U.S. looking the other way at everything that's going on in Honduras? I mean, that hypocrisy right now is a nauseating part, among other things.
Yes, yes. With all of this, I mean, of course, you were very inspired by the persistent activism in Honduras, and maybe you could talk just a bit about some of the amazing examples of resistance.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that goes on the mainstream media, and this has been going on since the coup, is it becomes just a victim story. So as things are terrible in Honduras, it's like you have this sort of image of the sobbing, powerless woman, when actually there's this tremendous resistance that has been going on since the coup that is an amazing model of social movements working together across a massive spectrum of different movements. I mean, the first 2 years after the coup, the National Front of Popular Resistance included the labor movement, the women's movement, the LGBTI movement, campesinos or small farmers, indigenous and Afro-indigenous people, middle-class people committed to the rule of law. I mean, you name Jesuits. I mean, it's a very beautiful coalition that is in many ways still in place in different form. You know, another thing missing from the stories is the many ways successful opposition political party, Libre, which probably won the election in 2013 and was a major player in 2017 as part of the opposition alliance. And you'd never know that there was political opposition. You'd never know that there were these beautiful social movements. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people protest in 2015 when it became clear that the president had stolen tens of millions of dollars from the National Health Service to finance his campaign. And right now there are all kinds of beautiful struggles going on at the grassroots of especially indigenous people and small farmers to protect land and water rights, and you don't hear about that either. Again, it's always this sort of this victim narrative. And if you look at the caravans, the people in the caravans are carrying signs that say Fuera Ho, which means Juan Orlando Hernandez out.
Mm-hmm.
At least three of them, of members of the caravans in the last year, have been opposition former Congress members. And it becomes just sort of like they're just poor downtrodden people, not people who have been having this beautiful, beautiful coalitions and beautiful protests and incredibly brave and are trying desperately to survive all this.
I'm speaking with Dana Frank, author of an important book, The Long Honduran Night. And Dana, I found it quite interesting that a major part of your activism in the last decade and also a portion of the book deals with how you have tried to influence Congress. And you admitted in the book that you had always thought working through Congress a waste of time, since everyone is bought off by corporate money. And I imagine a lot of our listeners are curious about why you decided to embark upon trying to pressure members of Congress to support human rights in Honduras and cutting back U.S. military aid.
You know, I just underscored, first of all, that in telling my own stories, always tell those stories as part of a larger movement all over Honduras and the U.S. and Canada, that it wasn't just me, that it was always a beautiful collective process, which was why it was so inspiring. And I try to capture that in the book while also leading through the reader through my own jumping into this world in Congress. And although I've had a lifetime as a U.S. history professor, I never went into the swamp, shall we say, you know. And so it was an incredible experience. In fact, I just got back from 2 weeks in Congress, and, you know, we sort of think we're powerless and you shouldn't call your Congress member. And let me tell you, you need to call your Congress member, and we can get to that. Because actually, through a tremendous grassroots movement, including, you know, labor movement, all kinds of activists, Latin America activist groups, faith-based groups, UNIT, School of the Americas Watch, Witness for Peace, all kinds of people, all over the United States, this grassroots movement has put pressure on Congress successfully. People may not know that there's something called the Berta Cáceres Human Rights in Honduras Act, which we built from below, and it calls for a suspension of U.S. military assistance to Honduras. And there were 71 members on it last year. It was first introduced in 2016, and it was just reintroduced last Thursday by Congress member Hank Johnson, with 43, now there are now at least 45 members of the House are on this bill already. And so it's really snowballing and much bigger this year and saying not in our name. And really, let's talk about where U.S. security funding is going. And of course, this lands in the middle, you know, the next day, then Trump says cut all the aid. We actually don't know if he's cutting the security aid or not. No one thinks that he hasn't completely informed Congress about that. But it does mean we have to have, yes, let's talk about a debate about the aid and the security aid and bracket that away from the so-called humanitarian aid. And then also we can talk about what is the development aid actually going to. But certainly we should be cutting the security aid, but I don't know if Trump is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we have this conversation, it's really important to see that there's a 10-year-old beautiful grassroots movement in solidarity in the United States, including people in Portland, and we want to give credit to them. Congress members Bonamici and Blumenauer are on the bill, and de Blasio's been on it in the past. It's not yet. Kurt Schrader's not on it. And we also, you know, want to thank Jeff Merkley, Senator Jeff Merkley, who was really great when the elections were stolen and called for a new election. He was just down in Honduras about 3 weeks ago, and we really need more from him now, and people need to call Jeff Merkley right now and ask him to sponsor Berta Cáceres' human rights in Honduras back in the Senate, because he's a really important lead on the Senate side.
Anything else, Donna, that we can ask listeners to do to support the people of Honduras?
Well, I mean, I think that people need to also talk to, you know, pressure Juan Wyden to follow Merkley, and, you know, Merkley is a very strategic person in all this, so there's something that Oregon can do. You know, you can also always write letters to the editor talking about root causes. You know, in a few days, you can Google H.R. 1945, just remember that year, and you can see the text of the bill, and you can see the evidence in there of why the security aid needs to be cut.
Well, Daniel, let's return to that comment you made earlier about U.S. economic interests in the area, because is that the main takeaway about this interlocking U.S. foreign policy military establishment, regardless of Democratic or Republican administrations, that continue to do the bidding of corporate capitalism?
Yeah, it's really important to understand it as a big global U.S. agenda supporting U.S.-based transnational capitalism. In Honduras, it's not like 1954 when the U.S. invaded Guatemala precisely to support United Fruit. It's much more of a giant geopolitical agenda supporting transnational capital that is allied to the United States. And so that's what we're talking about here. And then the U.S. Southern Command is also an engine that runs of itself, that has its own interest in getting military funding and is cooperating very closely with Honduras drug traffickers at the top to bottom of the Honduran military. So the military piece in there is important, too. But it's also this sort of raw geopolitical power that the U.S. is trying to assert and reassert in complicated ways. And, you know, watch out now, because you'll see this new Cold War language about Russia and China and even Iran, that if the U.S. didn't back the dictator in Honduras, well, they wouldn't put it this way, that they'll rush into that vacuum. And it's the U.S. that is spreading repression in Honduras, not the Chinese and the Russians. And it's really important to see that this larger geopolitical thing. And the other that is all about defending U.S.-based transnational capitalism. You know, the other piece of this is under the Trump administration is a very ideologically driven foreign policy, which everyone in Washington is saying. The person driving the policy is Senator Marco Rubio, and he is obsessed with Cuba and Venezuela, as are John Bolton, the National Security Advisor in the White House, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. So the attacks on Venezuela and Nicaragua and Cuba would be next. It's a very sort of purely ideological thing. And in fact, a lot of this about Honduras and supporting Juan Orlando is about Venezuela. I mean, the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, Kimberly Breyer, was just down there a week and a half ago or so, and she tweeted in her comments about Juan Orlando, the president of Honduras, that, you know, I thanked him for his something to this effect. I thanked him for his support from Juan Orlando, also discussed security, drug trafficking, and immigration. So and Bolton said more or less the same thing.
Dana Frank, sorry, we have to end here. And thank you so much. Dana Frank, historian, activist, and author of the book The Long Honduran Night. And she will be speaking next week in Corvallis, Tuesday, April 10th at Grassroots Books and Music, 7 p.m., and Wednesday, April 11th in Eugene at the University of Oregon Night Library at 4 p.m. Thanks again, Dana.
Oh, guys, thanks so much, Lori.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Thanks to all our contributors today, Bill Resnick and Michael Hirsch, Clayton Morgridge, Lori Mercier, and Dana Frank. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the grounds up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the OMO mission. This is KPOO Portland, and as always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the OMO Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at OMO on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at OMOVarietyHour, all one word, at gmail.com. Now stay tuned for Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein interviews Sarah Taylor, a longtime resident of the Linton neighborhood and co-founder of the Environmental Middle School, a public school dedicated to social and environmental justice through place-based service learning to talk about Portland's sacrifice zones. At 11, it's Madness Radio with host Will Hall. And at 11:30, KBOO's Suzanne LeGrand interviews Carolyn Criado Perez, writer, broadcaster, feminist activist, and author of Invisible Women, Gender Bias in a World Designed for Men.